This is a Pinball News production.
Thank you. What we're going to do is go through some archives that that I've accumulated through what I call the Gene Deal. And if anybody knows me, they know what the Gene Deal is all about. But fortunately, in that deal, I came across a vast vault of folders that go back to game number one, Suspense, that Williams did. And I'm absolutely honored to be up here with Duncan Brown. Duncan and I share a common passion of the history of pinball and Williams specifically. And when he was able to obtain the actual original drawings for the play fields, he was going through those, seeing notes, seeing machines that never went to production. He knew what I had, so we corroborated and came up with solutions. It's a lot of detective work going through these archives, trying to get a good visual of how Williams produced games, and more importantly, who was at Williams producing these games and what roles they played. Duncan is, Roger Sharp is also a historian when it comes to Williams, but Duncan is probably, he's far above me as far as knowing the details of Harry Williams and his beginnings and all the way up to the end, I guess. So Duncan's going to do a brief history of Harry, and then we'll dive into some of these archives and some of the scans we did. I have 200 or more scans, so we're most likely not going to get through them unless we go click, 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 click. So bear with us as we scan through some of them. At any time, if you have questions, if you see something or if we say something and you want to have a comment, just feel free to raise your hand and we'll be more than happy to take the question, because if we get too far, you have to jump back, and sometimes it's difficult to go back and try to know what you're asking about. So take it away, Duncan.
Okay. I will say I just stumbled into the role of pinball historian, mostly thanks to Steve Kordek. So it wasn't really much of my doing, but I now have possession of most of his archives that he had while at Williams. So there's a lot of stuff I can have access to. And in looking through it all, a lot of times I come up with questions, and then it turns out that James has got all the engineering archives. Steve had mostly like promotional archives. So together we can end up solving a lot of questions that you wouldn't otherwise be able to figure out, mostly for the benefit of Internet Pinball Database. We have three-way emails with Jay a lot to try to solve mysteries. And hopefully somebody cares. I mean, the information all ends up in the IPDB eventually, and hopefully it's of use to someone. One interesting thing, when I was going through a lot of this information I got from Steve, I would always see the initials GTH. In the back of my mind, I always wondered, okay, who's GTH? Harry always signed his stuff HEW, Steve Kordek signed his Steve Kordek, you know, but GTH was a mystery to me. So one thing I found when I briefly got those playfield drawings from Williams that I then sent to the Strong Museum was a lot of them had notes from Harry on the bottom to Gordon. And then talking with James, it turns out GTH is Gordon T. Horlick, who was a really early employee of Williams. So to give you a little brief history of Williams, Harry had worked for and owned several companies on the West Coast. I think who made contact? Is that Pacific something or other?
Pacific Amusement,
right. And I worked for Exhibit Supply. And so eventually he came to Chicago and hooked up with Lynn Durant, and they started United, which I believe was mostly reworking games during the war out of other games, basically conversion kits, because they couldn't get supplies. And then I am sad to say I don't know this whole story, because Steve Kordek would never tell me, but it was something about a woman. And you can only imagine, I think Lynn and Harry were both kind of womanizers. They had some big falling out, and Harry left in a huff and started his own company. And the world is much richer for it. So not too far into the formation of that company, I think you said like 47 or 48, he somehow found this guy, Gordon Horlick, who ended up going on up through the company, becoming an engineer, a vice president, and was basically his go-to guy. And I think these notes on the playfields indicate to me that Harry had already moved back to California. He didn't much like the Midwest. And so he was sending in this stuff and putting notes on it to Gordon just to tell him, you know, here's what's going on with the game, here's what I'm thinking. Now let me go through, I guess James is going to kind of concentrate on the first 10 games in Williams' history. So I pulled together everything I had from Steve Kordick's archives of the first 10 games in the Williams' history, and I'll just show those to you. There's very little in the archives on the first game. I mean, there was no playfield drawing left, no PR photo, although obviously one was taken to make this ad. This is an ad from Billboard. No flyer, nothing. But Steve had that in his archives, so that was the very first game they made. It's dynamic.
Yeah, that was actually the first game that they made designed themselves.
Oh, right.
To go back to Gordon Horlick's contributions, when United, Harry was working at United, Gordon actually worked at United. He designed the game Rio at United. And then, of course, Harry went off, started Williams. And then shortly after that is when Gordon left United to go with Harry Williams at Williams. And both Harry Williams and Gordon Horlick shared one passion, and that, or more than one passion, but the main one was general aviation. They were both pilots and flew, and that's what really bonded them throughout their lives. And it's it shows where in some of these folders we have notes between Gordon and Harry, and you can see how close their relationship was. And we'll touch on later how Gordon and Harry continued to work with each other even after Williams. So I'll turn it back over to Duncan and let him go through some of his slides.
I think it's safe to say that Lynn Durant and Harry Williams didn't much like each other after that, after he went off and formed his own company and then poached one of his best employees. I think they probably never talked again. Ironically, just to skip ahead a few years, Seaberg eventually bought United and then bought Williams, and so all the companies were all back together again, but Lynn and Harry were long gone at that point. Here's Dynamite's playfield drawing. Even from the earliest days, they were doing a lot of real engineering work. I mean, this was not some fly-by-night company doing napkin sketches and stuff. Harry did these full drawings, and there's the PR photo for Dynamite. There's Amber, the third game they ever did, and it's PR photo. I mean, they were putting together real games and doing it right. Number four is Smarty, and these games were so simplistic back then. This is pre-flipper, just some holes and some bouncy things and some switches, and then there's the game.
By the way, Jay, take note of this because you have Smarty and Showgirl number four and number four, and Smarty should be number four and Showgirls number five.
No, back then, well, I don't know, you can probably see it better on the drawing than the PR photo. They used flipper-shaped plastics. I mean, I guess that's where Harry Mabbs got the flipper from. He just made them move instead of being bolted to the playfield. Yeah, it's totally a flipper. I mean, it's the exact same thing. It's actually the I've got a game that old. On the very bottom, there's some little ridges molded into it, so when you bolt it down to the playfield, it doesn't spin around. It's not supposed to spin. But other than that, I mean, from the top side, it is the exact flipper shape we all know and love. I guess I don't know. You can't see them very well there, but.
And keep in mind, these games are 1946 into 47.
Yeah. Right. These are all pre-flipper.
The man who designed that flipper bag was Charlie Kasten.
Well, there you go. Okay.
He was an idea man that worked with all the pinball manufacturers making plastic parts.
Mm-hmm.
He did a lot of the plastic stuff. So, Harry Mabbs
Right. Okay. I did not know that.
Charlie worked for Foremost?
Yeah.
Yeah, Foremost made all the plastics forever. They probably still do. They're still around, yeah. Okay. There's Showgirl, which is number 5, as James said. And the finished game. I can only imagine how they... what kind of tripod they used to get up high enough to take a picture of some of these games. Although I did see later on, there was like kind of this behind-the-scenes photo of a game, Swinger or something, much later on. They actually took a platform and raised the game up like this, put the back legs up a couple of feet, and so then the camera was flat on the ground taking this kind of picture. I mean, the game was just about ready to flip over.
Was there a particular company that they used for these?
Statler Studios was the big one back in these days, and then later on there was another one. What I wouldn't give to find where the Statler Studios negatives went, but I can't find any trace of them anymore. And they did the photos for everybody. I mean, I've got Genko photos that are Statler Studios, and they were the go-to company for taking these photos. There's Tornado. And you can see a lot of times, unfortunately, this one isn't big enough to see, but a lot of times they would give it different names. So there's something crossed out there, and then it became Tornado. And when I was going through all these, I made notes of all that and gave them to Jay. I kind of buried Jay in information. I'm not sure if it's all in the database yet, but yeah. But eventually it'll all say, you know, was formerly known as whatever, and there'll be a little bit more history on it. And there's Tornado, the completed game. And it's interesting on a lot of these photos. I mean, they're like 8x10 photos, and I've scanned them at high resolution. Sometimes you can zoom in and see they've been played a lot. There's dirt tracks on them and stuff. I mean, James' files have a lot of playtesting data. You know, Sam Stern and Harry Williams and Gordon Horlick were all beaten on these games and recording their scores and their experiences. There's Cyclone. We're getting closer to flippers, but we're not there yet. And there's the finished game. That's actually got like this elevated ramp on it way back then, a wire rail ramp. That's actually, I've got a Cyclone that's going to the Strong Museum, if we can figure out some way to get it there. Wow. Oh, okay. Wow, if somebody had the plans for the first game, I'd like to know where those went. No, but I mean, where did the original go that they made the copy from? Because
Steve was involved in making
it. It wasn't there when I got it. Someone had filched it by then. Yeah. I mean, we could get a copy of Rob's copy, but I'd like to know who has the original. Yeah. Well, no, we have this scan. Here's Torchy. That's the one with the magnet thingies. I now have one of these games, and I'm going to fix that up and bring it to Expo. It looks like that had a whole bunch of names, and they finally settled on Torchy. And then there's the complete game, and that is indeed what it looks like. I have one sitting in my garage. There's Flamingo, number 9, the completed game. And I do not have the playfield drawing for All Stars, but there's the complete game in a very weird cabinet. Is that one of the ones? There was a couple of these baseball games they made in a bunch of different cabinets, like they were trying to decide how to do it. So there may be a like normal leg version of that, too.
And that may have been, I'm not sure when Sam Stern came in and bought half of the company. Sam Stern was really big on baseball games, and you can see his influence taking place after he came into it. They were just making baseball game, pinball game, then baseball game.
And horse games. It would appear to be Sam that was really into the horses. So, yeah, I mean, there's your Stern history goes back that far. I mean, he was a really early believer in Harry, bought half the company, eventually bought Harry out. I think Harry was happy to be bought out. He could move back to the West Coast, although he kind of kept his fingers in it throughout the years.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, it was quite the trio there. That's the story that will probably never be told because they're not around to ask anymore. But those three really made this company run. And then now we get into James's 200 scans, and I'm going to let him deal with that.
Oh, yeah, let me go with that. This is actually the only engineered drawing that I have from the very first game, Suspense. So this would, you can see, it's difficult to see it, but where it says drawn, there's the initials BW. And as I did the detective work, keep going through the files, I discovered that BW is Bradley Williams. I do not know if he was related to Harry Williams, but Bradley Williams was the first chief engineer at Williams. So that's the first known, or the first one that I have of the engineer drawings. This is the first schematic of Suspense, so this is their first game schematic. So I'm going to be delving into more of the how they were built and who built them side of this. So I'm going to click through quick because there's multiples. This is Dynamite number 2, again schematic. This is a production schedule sheet that would show the daily production, the parts that were used. So of course, as we all know, back then there were no computers. Everything was written by hand. There weren't copying machines, no scans. It was done by hand, and this is for Smarty. They were doing per day, it was roughly 150 a week, but they were working 6 days a week. And I think I have some of that in there as well. This is just an early letter from Williams, T.L. Murata, who was the general manager at Williams. And this is to the Kinsey Manufacturing, and it's just a P.O. update in this October of 1946. So these are just showing who was involved in Williams and at what level.
Kinsey looks to me to be what we all know these days as Link Smith. They made cabinets and maybe drilled and put together playfields. They didn't do the art. Even back then, it was Ed Posters doing the art.
This is a wiring, or the plastic
Bill of material,
I guess you could call it. The interesting thing here is the signature at the bottom is Jim McCaffer. He worked at Williams from the inception up into when I assume he retired. His son, John McCaffer, his nephew, John McCaffer, came into Williams in the 70s, I want to say, and John McCaffer worked for Williams until they closed the pinball down. I don't know if he's still at Williams or what became of him, but that just shows that two generations basically were working at Williams. Clicky, clicky. This would reflect the basically the production numbers for Showgirl. This is the PO list, and it basically reflects that they made right at 2,000 games for Showgirl. This is just a continuation of that. And it just says, the thing I put in here is down at the bottom where it says prices, and it says to be negotiated by H.E. Williams and Mr. Strawson of, I believe it was Kinsey as well. This is the production schedule for Showgirl, and here it is showing that they were basically making 50 games a day at this point. So it bucked up to close to 350 games after the first couple.
I've been astounded looking through these, how many games they made. Like, Stern these days would be happy to have the production runs Williams was having in their first few games back before flippers or anything. I mean, They were making 2,000 to 4,000 of games regularly.
The numbers that I see reflect that they initially would forecast a run of 1,500 games, and they would either back off of that or add to that. This is, again, to McKenzie. I don't know if I went backwards. This is Smarty Cables BOM, and they actually added up the numbers. Westin is a very good hotel, but unfortunately they have not upgraded their projector technology to HDMI, so we're on VGA, and so you really can't get a good look at some of these scans. But what it reflects here is there was approximately 1/8 of a mile of wiring in the pinball games back then. And they were really simple games, and to have that much wire was, to me, remarkable. This is off of Dynamite, if I recall. Another engineered drawing that shows its age. It's drawn by Jim McCaffrey, so he was working in the engineer department. Torchy, again, 1500 was the initial order of that. Get to some of the juicy stuff here. This is an engineer change order, ECO as they call them, which shows that Bradley Williams was indeed the chief engineer, and this was on the baseball game All-Star. These are drawings. They're 8.5 by 11 drawings. Yes, sir.
On that engineering change order, was there any indication that that was in the middle of the production run?
It's dated 9/22/47, so we could go back. This does not indicate that it was in the middle. Some of these engineer change orders would say start on game number 200 or whatever.
Actually, this one does too. Effective All-Star number 300. Up the very top line.
Yeah, I do see that. Yeah. So that would have been started after game number 300. Good catch.
So there'd be variants of the machine then.
Yeah, although these are springs, so you probably would be one of those hard to figure out things.
These drawings, we have Duncan and I have gone back and forth as to what these drawings represent. I have these 8.5 by 11 drawings. Some of them are like this, where you would assume that it was possibly a manual type drawing. But I have not seen the manuals back then showing these type of drawings. And some of these drawings predate the large drawings and vice versa. This one is a very plain one, so I would actually think this particular one was used for a manual or for...
It could have been just for manufacturing, just to for the people on the line to figure out what goes where. What threw James a lot was a lot of these drawings are signed Gordon Horlick or GTH.
Yes, GTH.
And so, did he design the game? No, he redrew the little drawing for whatever purpose. For some of them look to be almost like for the software guy, the guy doing the relays and stuff. Here's a drawing you can hold in your hand to let you know what the rules are and what's supposed to happen where without having to get out the big, huge, life-size drawing.
This is the first document that I came across that has these initials scribbled, and you really can't make out what those initials are. But I started seeing these initials as I went through the documents, and those are Gordon Horlick's initials, GTH. And
yeah, all the stuff I've got, he always basically printed his initials with a template. I don't think I ever found anything that had him sign it. He was always Mr. Engineer.
So this would be Bonanza. Bonanza was game number... Anybody got it real quick?
12, maybe?
12 up there.
Yeah,
there you go. This is scorecards for Bonanza. These are the original scorecards that were in the folder. Now, this is going to the style of drawing that I was seeing very frequently. So instead of a very sterile drawing, these are sort of rough sketch type drawings. These are POs or acknowledgement of receipt, and these are up here because it's interesting. This is Link Smith, and that is actually John Link's signature on those. And I think there's only a couple of documents that I have that have his initials. And this is, again, Link Smith, and this has Mr. Smith's signature on it. So there is the reason it's called Link Smith. And we're up to about 1947. He mentioned the play sheets where they would go in and test the games. This is the sheet that they would use to show the score. Again, this is Gordon Horlick. This is game number 4. And so they would show basically the games and what the score would be, and that's how they would calculate what they would set the replay at.
The Xing is, Mike, you shoot this and you shoot that. Okay.
Yeah.
The numbered bumpers, how often you hit it.
Yeah, I'm guessing, you know, did I light that numbered bumper in this game? Which
You should ask the people who did test playing in the 70s, probably, because they said this was still very similar.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, this is Jim McCaffer doing his testing. Game number 3, Sonny. This would be, I haven't really determined, it looks like that is Harry Williams, but it also could have been Bradley Williams. I'm not a handwriting expert. But on these, you can actually see at the bottom where they show what the game would have taken in and what the game would have paid out, what the net revenue would have been. So the old, were they supposed to be gambling machines? Well, yeah, they were. Stormy schematic. The reason I put this up here is because it shows who was receiving these within the company. So these are the kind of things that I would come across that would tell me certain names that would be in the company. In this particular case, it doesn't show what their titles were, but it does give me a clue when I would see initials. Hey, this is the person's name. So on this one, you see Harry Williams, Gordon Horlick, Catton, Kennedy, Paxton, Reinhardt, and Bradley Williams was still there at that time as well. So these are the documents. Those kind of documents helped me do that detective work, trying to figure out who was in the company. And later on, I would be able to figure out, in many cases, what their role was in the company. Another one of the drawings, this is for Tennessee. This is for Rainbow. This is the relay strip. And I wanted to get into this. Many of you that work on electromechanicals can relate to this and know this. This was their operating system, their platform, much like a System 7 Williams. So when they designed games, they didn't go back and reinvent the wheel. They had a system that they used, and basically they would reprogram this. Electromechanicals are mechanical computers, ones and zeros, switches on and off. The processor was the motor, and your processing speed was how fast you could get that motor to turn and still have all the commands follow it, the software's following. So if you sped the motor up too fast, then the relays couldn't keep up, so you had to slow the motor down. So your processing power was that motor, how fast it could go. Your memory, of course, would be score reels, your cams, and things like that. You would have buffers, relays, that would momentarily go on, off. So that's what the electromechanicals were, and simply computers came about by turning these mechanical switches into tubes back in the days. And then, of course, going forward, they turned them into transistors. So this would be a relay strip. This was actually a template. And then most of the time, this would be Gordon Horlick going in and doing the programming, which is the wiring, to get the features to work within the game. This is from Automatic Novelty Sales to Harry Williams. This is a letter that basically said Mr. Williams was going to go to was wanting to see Harry at a show, and then the letter goes on to say, "I want to congratulate you on your last two games. As for play, they have it." And then one of your sonnies took in $147.90 last week. That is as much money as I've ever taken in.
How much?
$147.90.
A nickel at a time.
A nickel at a time.
What was the price of the game? $300, $400? What was the price of the game?
Well, here, there was a letter that referenced that they were, it says, you can build a game for $1,000, but if it's, you know, the turd, then, you know, such and such. So it's estimated that the games were selling $600 to $800, I want to say. But in this one, he also mentions that there were a couple of their last, that there were games that were not up to snuff, so apparently there were a couple of games that weren't so good that this guy was talking about. He finally came up with some good ones, but there's some problems here that need to be addressed.
I find it interesting that they kept this kind of mail for that long time and just did not throw it away.
There was one interesting point in there. The guy said his techs were pulling out the cheap Williams parts and putting in the United equivalents, and that was probably painful for Harry to read.
So again, some more of the drawings, and this is the Tennessee motor. Again, this is the processor of the old systems, and of course, the other part of that is the processing speed, of course, is the speed of the motor, but the power is how many switches they had attached to it. So that would be your bits, you know, 8-bit, but of course they didn't think in that terminology. It was just how many switches were attached to that motor and how many stacks were to it. And this one basically was a single stack with the switches attached to it. So it was really very rudimentary in that time.
I notice Gordon signed it in his engineer block letters up top, but then when he revised it, he actually signed it.
Yeah, so this one was done originally January of 48 and then revised February of 48.
Those last few slides, of course, Sonny's the first clicker. I have it.
Yeah.
And it's amazing because, you know, some of those things like nobody's making eight and things like that, that is so pivotal. I mean, some of that communication about Sonny is that decision to come into, you know, the clicker business against Gottlieb, because that, of course, was, you know, an issue, obviously,
right,
before you could do that. And they knew, I think, that was going to be way that that company was going to go, and how are they going to do it better than Gottlieb? You know, so I mean, in terms of engineering history, here you have it, because as you know, Williams would flex with those flipper arrangements and the functions. So that's fabulous.
And if I recall, Gordon Horlick actually designed Sonny, didn't he? Was that his?
I don't know.
I think that's what was uncovered at one time. Again, this is another sketch of Tennessee. So there, on Tennessee alone, in the folder of Tennessee, that I think there's three different sketches, the smaller sketches. This is Virginia. Again, you can actually see the flipper, you can see in the middle above the 5 and the 6, where they have a flipper mechanism and they're actually pointing that it's going to be flipping in this direction. Again, Kinsey, this is something I brought for Duncan's viewing. This is basically a letter that says, cancel the project of a game called New Orleans, and we're going to go with a game called Yanks.
I knew you'd like that.
That's why I told you, you better be here.
Yeah. I have a PR photo for New Orleans, complete built game, paint, great photo, and it kind of the negative number from Statler Studios put it between Yanks and whatever the one was before, but it made no sense. I mean, there was no missing project number, nothing. But and here's the answer. They just reused the project number, which was unheard of.
So it opens up, cancel our letter of remaining 1,500 units on purchase order for New Orleans and substitute the following. We are now going to do Yanks. So that was the reason for New Orleans coming off the line and Yanks going on.
And what could have possibly been so bad about a game that simplistic that they would abandon all of the work they put into it and do another game? I have no idea.
This is something that's somewhat interesting. This is a production schedule that actually shows the employees. The first column is employees working, second column is employees absent, and then it would show percentage of employees actually working, so 95%, 94%, and then it would show the productions on out, and then there were on the last column, reasons for line holdups, so when there was a holdup on the line on that day, and this is daily, so if there was a holdup on the line, this is what held up the line on that day. The employees, the number of employees, at the first one it looks, I believe it's 224 So it would be in the 200s, roughly 250. And the other thing that this reflects as well, I went back and said they were doing games 7 days a week. This goes Monday through Saturday. So it does show, this is the document that showed me they were working 6 days a week in production. So these are the kind of documents when I come across, I call these the juicy ones. It gives us more of an insight as to what was going on with the company and how many people were doing it, what the numbers were. This was where they were going to do New Orleans, and this is the this reflects that possibly 10 or 11 of them were made, because it shows the numbers of the ones they actually, how many they received of the light boxes. They received 9 of them. So these would have been the sample. So they were basically building 10 sample games at that time. So this somewhat shows that most likely they did do those sample games and decided we're not going to make it.
And I noticed Playfield's 2 advertising posters. So they were straight to the
next. Yeah, they had a lot of vendors. Somebody made the wood, and then they had to send it to Ad Posters for screening, and then the glass came back from Ad Posters.
And again, this was showing that they were ordering yellow buttons, 27,000 of them, and to be used on our game New Orleans.
But then the little note says, well, we can use up 18,000 of them on Yanks.
Yeah. Going back to, this is Harry Williams, HEW. These were his initials. This showed him playing this is not game number 3 as in the model number 3. This is sample game number 3, and this is of Yanks. And it would show, there's notations down here saying hole changed, flipper changed, and things like that. So they would set it up differently as he played it. And this is Gordon Horlick playing the same game. And you compare the scores, Harry was a lot better at baseball games than Gordon was. This goes to basically a checklist of the game Yanks. So it would show, these are not actually Harry's initials. This is somebody writing his initials saying, Harry says to run Yanks ahead of New Orleans. And then it says, Harry Williams to do this, that, and everything else. So this was in April 9th of 48.
Well, so maybe originally, we'll write a confirming letter canceling New Orleans and setting up Yanks. Okay, well, yeah. So maybe at first they thought they'd delay it, but then, boom.
Yeah. And then it also shows up there, Yanks, 1,000 units. New Orleans novelty, they were one of the biggest distributors, purchasers of Williams games. And this was to Gordon. And I think this might have been one of the letters where they were saying something was burning out. The bulbs, some Yanks were burning out prematurely, and eventually they were coming up with a solution, and New Orleans novelty came up with putting a resistor to drop the voltage of the lamps. This is Do What Diddy. This is actually the print, gum paper print layout for that particular game. So this would be what they would print out, and then of course put on relay banks and things like that inside the cabinet.
Gum paper means it's sticker.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now we're back to some more of those drawings that I was referring to. These reflect more, when they put the arrows and things like that, to me that reflects more of an engineer note versus a drawing for a manual or anything like that. Threw this in there for you, Jay. This is a switch drawing for the game New Orleans. This is just, in these folders, there's just stacks of these kind of doodlings, drawings, ideas for mechanisms, schematics, and things like that. It appears this one was some type of flipper-related idea. Don't know if it was anything that they ever used, but most of these would be, Gordon Horlick would be the person that would initial them. This is for Gizmo, which holds a special place in my heart. My dog was Gizmo. Again, another letter from Newling's Novelty. Just throwing these in there to show you how the correspondence was going between the operators, distributors, and the company. And they were very blunt about what they had to say. There was no political correctness in the way they wanted to get their point across. Rainbow, Harry Williams, Gordon Horlick. The reason I put this in here, it shows on the date 10/9/48, now Gordon Horlick is the chief engineer of Williams. Bradley Williams soon disappeared from the archives from that point. After a few months of this, I no longer saw Bradley Williams in any of these documentations, so apparently he moved on. Gordon Horlick became the chief engineer, and he remained the chief engineer until the late 50s when I believe it was the first consolidated purchase of Williams, and then he became the vice president of Williams. So he moved up in the ranks and files within Williams. He was always one of the top people, close friends with Harry Williams. And the reason that we really wanted to bring him to the forefront is many, many people have never heard of the man, Gordon Horlick. But yet, I once asked Roger Sharp if he knew about Harry Williams, and he said he was one of the four pivotal people in the early days of pinball. So he ranked him up there with the Harry Williams and the Harry Mabs and all these. But yet nobody's really heard of this man because he's been stuck in these archives for all these years. And it's somewhat been a quest of mine to get his name out there. He deserves to be in the Pinball Hall of Fame. He deserves recognition for his contributions to pinball. He designed many games at Williams, mostly in the early 50s, late 40s, early 50s. And then Williams brought in Harry Mabs from Gottlieb, who contributed. And, of course, Norm Clark went to work for Williams in the early 50s and remained on and designed games. So Gordon Horlick was overshadowed by the names of the people that carried on and were still around when the pinball conventions and shows started. So they were the ones that got the recognition. Gordon Horlick, I went on a quest to find out some more about Gordon Horlick, and I eventually tracked down his son who lives in Florida. Through correspondence with his son, he's the one that told me that he worked for United, designed Rio. Him and Harry Williams were close personal friends, and they worked together, of course. But he also went on to say that after Harry Williams left Williams, and eventually Gordon Horlick in the mid-60s left Williams, Harry and Gordon continued to work together and send in the drawings that Duncan was talking about yesterday, the lost drawings of Harry Williams. It appears that Harry Williams was the one that would come up with most of the designs, and then Gordon Horlick would make the tweaks to make it a better playing game. And that appears to be what happened throughout the history of the early Williams history. Gordon Horlick would do the tweaking, we'll call it redesign, to get the games to become good playing games.
Yeah, it's like Harry designed the games to be interesting and Gordon made them playable.
Exactly. Some more of those scans. I have approximately 100 of these in these files of various games, Jim. This is, of course, the ball counter mechanism. Call it the memory, as I call it. More of the sketches. And these sketches started taking on Gordon Horlick in sort of notations of rule sets and things like that. This was Dallas, relay stick and game connection. So these are wiring color codes. This is the initial handwritten instruction sheet. So they would, of course, handwrite it. Then they would turn it over to be typed. and then it would be sent over for the font layout to the print company. So that was the process that they would go through to create instruction pamphlets. And that was for the game Dallas. This is Stampede. It started out as Stampede, and then the title turned into Dallas. Some more Dallas Motor, Dallas Ball Counter. A lot of this is redundant, and I just threw it in there because I actually threw it all to him, and I was hoping that we would be able to consolidate it, but both of us were so busy we weren't able to delete out the redundancy in it, so it can get a little long just because of that.
I win, right?
Yeah.
So this would show liberal scoring, conservative scoring, instruction sheets.
I like how they parenthetically say loose and tight, just in case you didn't get it.
Yeah. This shows, if I put a side-by-side comparison of this versus the earlier Relay Bank, it shows that their operating system was expanding as they were coming up with new features. And it was simply add more relays.
And is this implying that the game was originally called Carolina and then they changed it to Maryland? Because I've heard of Maryland and never heard of Carolina.
So this would show that originally the title was indeed Carolina and was changed later to Maryland.
Why didn't they like Carolina?
I don't know, maybe.
They voted the wrong way, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. Or they couldn't come up with a decision between North or South Carolina, so they just went with Maryland as a tiebreaker.
This is a generic one. I don't recall which folder this was in. Boston. They went on a stretch where they were naming games of states and cities. There was a stretch of almost 10 games in a row. So it seemed like that was the end theme at that time.
This United was a,
this just shows a void verbal order. So these would be inner office notes that they would pass. This was Jim at Caffer actually sending this one out. Freshy. Lincoln. This is changes for Freshy, etc. See who wrote it. This is Gordon's notes to Gentleman Lincoln regarding things that needed to be changed. All flipper shafts. Oh, this was showing that they were putting graphite on their flipper shafts and solenoid plungers. So Freshy started out with the title Vermont. So this was towards the end of that run of states and cities. They were like, well, you know, we pretty much run that in the ground. We need to start fresh. A de-icer.
Yeah, de-icer. Who came up with that name?
Gordon.
Private pilot.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, Gordon and Harry would have had their planes de-iced.
So we're up to late 49. To give you an idea, going back to Jim's database, from 1946 to 1956, they made right around 175 games. So that's 17 and a half games per year that they were making.
And thousands titles of each.
So they were pumping out some games. This is just...
Where are they all?
Therefore, they needed states and cities because you can't come up with names quick enough for them.
Yeah.
Titles.
We're running on time, but Rob's not here. Usually he has to get the big hook and get me out of here. So. This is just something between Chicago Engineering, who supplied them with transformers, so they were coming up with a different transformer for different voltage. Dreamy... Now we're expanding the operating system even further. More relays.
And still changing the names of games.
Yeah, this was Valentine, which became Sweetheart.
Same theme.
More of the operating system. Georgia. This one was Georgia. Started out Broadway. Actually started out as Deluxe. Then became Broadway. Then became Georgia. This is to Sam Stern from Harry, just a note.
At what time did they change it to have game numbers instead of names at the beginning? So later titles, they mainly are talking about number 499, and the name came later. Here, you always see only names on it, but I think at some point they decided to to better work on a number, just on a name, on the final name?
They were working consecutively with numbers. Just in some of the, in these folders, as you go through them, like the bill of material. And to give you an example, I wanted to show you this.
Oh, yeah, this is good.
This is the parts list for Dynamite, the number two game that they made.
How many pages is that?
It's approximately 10 pages. This is the parts list for 8 Ball Deluxe. So you can see how games got a little bit more pricey, got a few more parts to them. So that's the comparison of the early games. And, of course, that would be the reason they could produce 17 different titles a year at that time. They didn't quite have as many parts inside of them. This is a gentleman. This starts a game that Harry Williams was working on when he was in California. And there was a gentleman there, and again, this was part of the detective work, by the name of Ed Collins. And Ed Collins was sending these notes to Harry Williams, or Gordon Horlick, and to Sam Stern. And of course, it was easy to recognize the initials EC when I saw this at the top. There was one note in here that finally gave us the clue of what was going on. When Ed Collins signed this off, he signs it off, "Yours truly, Williams West Coast Super Laboratories." And there was, Jay, I think in one of your games you said that you were trying to figure out where Melrose Avenue was in Chicago. It was in California. That's where Harry Williams was working out of. They had an office that they called Williams in California on Melrose Avenue.
Don't remember which game.
It's listed in here. This is a Western Union that was sent. I want to say this might have been some kind of a baseball game. It's in here somewhere.
I'll just search on Melrose.
Some more correspondence. This is Motor Search, which was the company that was making the motors for Williams. There's notations in here again from to Gordon, from Ed, out on the West Coast.
Motor Research became Multi Products.
Yes. Yes. This is La Paz. I can't remember if La Paz became Ragmont.
Yes.
Yes. Nifty. Samsung.
Now, that was on the Playfield drawing, too, where Samsung was the original name, and then it became Nifty.
Don't know if that was in reference to Sam Stern.
Yeah, must have been.
Shushu, this is a Gordon Horlick title. I remember that. And you can see that the flippers at that time were still reversed.
Weird.
They were not... Where Steve, I believe, was it Steve Kordick that eventually... Put him at the bottom opposing? Yeah.
Well, he put him at the bottom, points
right.
out like that. And then
yeah. Right.
Gottlieb made him points in.
And again, this is showing Harvey, I believe, is the game. And now they ran the total of Hardy up to 250 units. It also shows the people that were there. These... Hay burners. These are the type of notes, schematic-wise, just handwritten layouts against stacks of those things in these folders. And this is Gordon Horlick working on hay burners, the horse game. Control Tower. We can pretty much figure out why they were doing a game called Control Tower. The template now is changing as far as the outhole goes for these games. Instead of the flat outhole, it is now basically a return out hole that they were using, and this is 1951. This is on here because this is Shoot the Moon, a game called Shoot the Moon. The thing that the note here is the 20 test games took a total of 55 minutes, whereas today you can play one game for 55 minutes. Yes, Tom?
Hey, James, just to back up a little bit, when you were talking about Williams naming games after states and cities.
Yes.
United also named games after states and cities, and United had a game called Carolina in 1949. So I'm wondering if that's why Williams had the chance.
Yeah, I've seen stuff like that before where Williams would change a name because oops.
Because United made about a dozen games with State of the City.
And I've always wondered, was it ad posters doing that? Like, hey, Williams, we're already screening a glass for United. You might want to change your name.
This is the game, the original 8-ball. Horseshoes, this is 51. This one was voided out, whichever one. Game called Sportsman. I don't know if that game was ever produced
or not. I think so, yeah.
Was it? Majorettes. This is just a lot of the scans that I wanted to throw in here. We were going to actually edit this down to a reasonable number, but you can see...
Now the flippers are on the right.
Yeah. Now you can see where the flippers are in this game. And this was 1953. Gordon Horlick's initials are on this. And again, it doesn't necessarily mean that he was the designer of the game. It just shows that he was revising things. Gun club, struggle bunnies.
Struggle buggies.
Buggies, yeah. So now you can see that the flippers are getting into the now traditional area. And it also reflects, if you look at the complexity of this play field versus the early play fields, they're really advancing those operating systems and the features of the games. This was Army-Navy, 53, Nine Sisters. This was a game originally called Blackjack, and then they turned it into a game called Dealer. This shows the material cost of the game, which totaled up to $103. Now, that's just the material cost of these items.
3 digits, 4.431.
Yeah. Thunderbird, Screamo, Skyway. This was the first official, they had the smaller ramp-type shot, right. But this is... the first game that Williams had that had an official ramp to it. And there are notes in the folder that show that Harry was designing this on the West Coast because he was sending notes back and forth. Actually, this is one of them that Harry sent. And the interesting thing here, I was telling you that these notes would show the relationship that they had. He signs it off, love and kisses Harry. So it's... But this is where he was telling him changes that needed to be made. Skyway again, QT, colors, motor research again. This shows how much the motors were costing, $3.41 but it shows, there's a little note up there. Apparently they renegotiated and they were able to get the price down to $3.23.
Yes.
That brings that BOM down. Motor research, same thing. Anything here? Oh, this shows that Jay McDonald was the purchasing agent for Williams at that time. So just more names in the files as far as who was who. This was, which game was this?
They made a couple of roll-down games.
Jubilee.
Yeah.
This is a drawing for a roll-down game called Jubilee. Williams was primarily, they didn't get into the arcades until later. They were pinball, baseball, horses, and that was pretty much it. As far as the pinball division goes. Did they have a slot division at that time?
No.
This is one of the few letters that I have, or notes, memos, whatever you want to call it, that actually has Sam Stern's signature on them, the original signature. There wasn't a lot of information in these folders with Sam's name on them.
Well, he wasn't really an engineering guy. He was the business guy.
It's reversed on bottom.
What's that?
It's reversed on bottom.
Yes.
Yeah, what they were doing, the reason that they did this sometimes was if they wanted to show the back view, they actually made the print on the back of the drawing. Some of these drawings, I don't know if we've already gone past them, like these type drawings, they would have a reverse print up on the upper left that would give you the reference whether it was the front or the back, and it was actually just part of the template. Game All-Star. Yeah, right here, you can see up at the top, you have the wiring side and you have the rivet side. So this would be the wiring side of that. Race the clock, et cetera, et cetera. This was the first game that actually used real scoring. So these are the boards for that. This is the 0 to 9 score unit, the 10 to 90 score unit, the 100 to 900. So that was the reason I guess I threw that in there. Three deuces, et cetera, et cetera. So you can see more notations on here as on a lot of these plastics. This is 1955, and it shows this is signed off by Harry Mabbs. So he actually came on to Williams 52, 53, I believe it was. It looks very vanilla here, but this is actually pencil drawn. It doesn't show up in the scan, so this is an original pencil draw of just a play adjustment, a feature adjustment on the game.
Letterhead.
It's a letterhead, and this one really came out light. It looks like it was, I don't know who signed that one off. It was a snafu. This is Harry Mabbs. Harry Mabbs again, Timbuktu. Piccadilly.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and they're using the old template and changing how the trough went.
So this is the old template. So they were changing the way the outhole was utilized, and they hadn't updated their own templates yet. This is Harry Mabbs' test sheet. This was a game, red, white, blue, I believe.
Yeah, they made a few of those. Mm-hmm. It's pretty limited.
Golden Nugget. I don't know if that game was ever made.
I think so.
It's more of the same. This is sort of towards the end, I hope. this was one of the documents where I actually was able to go in and see who had what position in the company. It shows on here purchasing, J. McDonald, tooling, go on down, and you can see Director of Engineering. Director of Engineering was Harry Williams. Gordon Horlick was Chief Engineer. Sales, on down the list, there was a Joe McQuaid, which was Product Engineer. And then at the bottom it says Vice President Sam Stern. So these are the documents that really filled in a lot of the gaps as far as who was in what position at the company. And this is a ECO that was approved by, that was initiated by Andrews, Rush Andrews, it looks like, and then approved by Gordon Horlick. And this is just more engineer drawings, four-bagger. There was a four-bagger. This was a baseball game. They had four-bagger regular model, and then they would have a four-bagger, which was the model number -A, and it was designed strictly for New York. And I assumed that they were doing that to get around the gambling laws.
Yeah, New York considered replays a gambling return, so you couldn't have replays in New York.
It's a shame this one didn't really come out well. This one goes in that shows the changing of the hierarchy a little bit. It does show the chief engineer for Gordon Horlick, Harry Williams, and all that. Let's skip through this because we're already over time, but what the heck.
Actually, you got 4 minutes.
We got 4 minutes? Sweet. Harry Mabbs, this is the this would just be a plastics list for the game Funhouse, the original Funhouse. And the company going, it was Northrop that was making the plastics. Let's see, 1957, more of the same. This one, Kings, Harry Mabbs. Harry Mabbs had a very recognizable handwriting as I was going through these folders. It was really easy to spot his. He had just a little bit of a shaky handwriting.
It got worse as time went on.
Yes, definitely. I want to get to This is a game that was came out as Reno, but it started out as Keno. And that is actually Keno, and they just changed it to an R. Jigsaw. This is where I started seeing Norm Clark coming into the picture, or later on. This was 58. I think he came in 55, 56, if I recall, through the files. More of Harry Williams, Mabs. This was another game that changed names, Whirlaway to Turf Champs. This is an actual pencil-drawn of Turf Champs thumper cap. Unfortunately, thanks to Weston, we don't have a real good projector here to show the details of it.
Actually, if you want to blame someone, I believe Mike Pasek's name is on that projector.
Yeah, let's blame Mike. It's easy to blame.
Yeah.
More test sheets, drawing. This is where the hierarchy actually changed. This is 1959, and you see the president, they actually list a president now, Sam Stern. Vice president, Gordon Horlick. Production engineer is now Joe McQuaid, and on down the line. So this
Harry Williams is notably missing.
Yes, Harry Williams is no longer in the hierarchy. There's an article, if you can ever find it, it's called True Magazine.
I've got a scan of that up if you search RGP or something.
Yeah, I've actually got two copies of it. It's a very detailed article about Harry Williams going back to the beginning, and it's interesting that the article was published 1960.
Yep.
But the interview took place before he actually left Williams, so it doesn't actually talk about him leaving Williams, but he had already left Williams. This is when Williams was purchased from Sam Stern and Harry Williams, and this is the hierarchy after that purchase was. Yes.
Maybe that's the reason they throw out the score reels of the games. I have three games, four stars, and another game who has no score reels at this time, 58 and 60.
Mm-hmm.
That was the beginning.
Yeah, they came out with a few games with score reels and then got rid of them again.
What was interesting, if you go through the database, is you would see they had a four-player game. And you would think, all right, they've innovated pinball to four players. And then it goes back one player, one player, one player, one player. Then maybe a four-player game. One player, one player, one player. And yes, you're right. It wasn't really until the late 50s that the two- and four-player game became the standard. And it's probably, it may have something to do with the style of the play of the game, the length of the game.
I think distributor feedback was probably in the
Yes. Yeah. And competition.
And price.
Mm-hmm. Some more showing the hierarchy. This was a game, I threw this in towards the end. This was something that they made, never went into production. It is basically an HO scale model in a big cabinet, and you had four tracks that the train would go on. I'm not really sure how the gameplay was, but it was called Select-A-Train. And it got some kind of an award at the AMOA show, like the most innovative game of the time. But I've never seen one, and it was the first time I heard of it as I was going through here and found the folder for it.
But we had many of this style in Germany in the 70s, and they all had Williams coin doors. So there was a company building things, and they were at railway stations. Kids could enter money and play around with the trains. At least we had many of them in Germany.
Maybe that's where they all went.
Yeah, that might be it.
Can you find one? Where did they all go?
Yeah. So that basically, what we did there is cover mostly the first 10 years. Perhaps next year we'll go into the next 10 years. We won't have quite as many slides. We'll have the juicy ones only, so to speak. I think we're about out of time, but anybody, quick questions, just in case? I think we were asking them as we went along, so hopefully everybody was satisfied with what they were seeing. So, yes, Tom.
Did you find any incidents of where they just made export games back in those days?
No, I didn't. The only thing that really showed differences is they would have a standard version and a New York version. That was about it. And sometimes the standard version would have a dash A after the model number, and then sometimes it would be assigned its own model number, a sequential number. But that was about it. I don't know that they were really export only. I don't know of any that they really did. We did find, through, as Duncan mentioned earlier, we found games that were not made that we were curious. We see evidence that they were there, and in some cases, like New Orleans, we could figure out what happened. And that's Duncan and I love that kind of stuff. That's what we're really into. Yeah. Yes, Dave.
How soon can we get a sequential project number list on backlast.org or somewhere?
Isn't it? Well, I guess IPDB has it if you click on the model number heading on the William.
Yeah, that's for the pinballs and horse games and things like that. The other games like the bowling game, they made a lot of bowling games as well going into the 50s.
And pool tables.
Don't you have a compiled list of everything?
Yeah.
There are gaps.
That's what I'd like to see is everything, all the rifles, all the pool
tables, whatever. Again, Jay was going to figure out some way eventually to put that on IPDB. He's got all my scans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's
just
no way to
put all the model numbers.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd be more than happy. I've got them. This is Duncan's laptop, but I've got them on my laptop as well. Anybody that wants a copy of these slides, just bring a stick, USB, or whatever they call it, SD card, and I'd be more than happy to give you a copy of it. And the other goal is we continue to have the information, is to make it available. That's our goal. We don't want to take this and put it back into a vault and to never be seen again. I actually have some of the folders here. Obviously, it's not practical to continuously take them out, put them back in, because some of them are fragile. But if you have a particular game that you would like to know, I brought games 1 through 100 with me. So if you have a particular game and you want to see something on it, it's possible that we could take it out and just show you what I do have. So, Dave, are we out of time yet? We're out of time. So.
Thank you.